It is my pleasure to introduce to you Matthew J. Frank, director of the Witherspoon Institute. His topic is freedom of religion in light of the Health and Human Services mandate.
For me to be here, let me say just a couple quick words about the Witherspoon Institute in addition to the kind words that Star just spoke. The Witherspoon Institute is coming up on its 10th anniversary. It was co-founded by someone known to many of you, I think, because he's come to this meeting in the past, Professor Robbie George of Princeton University. He and my boss, Luis Tellez, the president of the Witherspoon Institute, founded it in 2003. We're dedicated to the cause of life, the cause of marriage, the cause of religious liberty. And we're trying to affect the academy through our conferences, our supportive research by scholars, our summer seminars for every age cohort from high school kids on up to young assistant professors who haven't earned tenure yet, everyone in between. So we're very active. We're located in Princeton. We're not part of Princeton University, but we're literally just right next door. And you can find out more about us at www.winst.org. We also publish, by the way, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, a daily essay publication called The Public Discourse, which you may know. You can find it at thepublicdiscourse.com. I'm really pleased to be here. I've said to several people since arriving late yesterday afternoon that the most stunning piece of news I've heard about this conference since my arrival is that this is only the fourth year you're doing it. I'm not as active a speaker as my friend Robbie George. I'm becoming more active since I've left the academy and entered on this kind of work. But I go around speaking at various venues, and I have to say, for the size, the comprehensiveness, the organization, the feeling of something solid and established, this is like something you all have been doing for 15 years, not for four. So you all deserve a round of applause. I'm here with you this morning to speak about the Health and Human Services mandate and the threat to both life and religious freedom. For the past 2 years, we've had a struggle over something known as the HHS mandate, a rule promulgated by the Health and Human Services Department of the federal government, led by Kathleen Sebelius, Secretary Sebelius, which is a mandate often referred to as the contraception and abortifacient mandate. The arguments against this policy, both legal and political, have been so compelling and yet so ineffectual with the Obama administration that we must conclude that the policy represents something very important to the president and his administration. I'll be reviewing those arguments, but first I think I need to review the story, just so we all have our facts straight about how we came to this pass. First of all, 3 years ago this month, the Congress enacted, by the shenanigans you're all familiar with, deeming it passed, forcing a vote, and so on, the Congress passed the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act for short, or Obamacare in everyone's vernacular. That was March 2010 that Congress enacted Obamacare. Well, in that monstrous bill, 900 monstrous in more ways than one, but it was hugely long, 900 plus pages, there are multiple places in the legislation that say the secretary shall direct, the secretary shall decide, the secretary shall provide. And there are all these secretaries shall littered through this bill, indicating that for all its great length and copious takeover of one-sixth of our economy by the federal government, the healthcare economy, the bill could have been far longer if they had put in all the detail that has emerged since then, because much of the detail has been filled in by Secretary Sebelius, and in some cases the Secretary of Labor or Secretary of Commerce, as the case may be, but mostly the Secretary of HHS, has been filling in these details, these gaps in the legislation where it said the Secretary shall provide. Well, one of those provisions was a dictate that employers who purchase group health plans for their employees. And by the way, all employers of more than 50 or more employees are required to provide health insurance in some fashion, either as self-insurers or by purchasing group health insurance for their employees. All employers who are buying health insurance must provide something called, in this category, preventive care at no cost. That means no deductible, no copay. Okay? So then the legislation says the secretary shall decide what is preventive care. The Secretary of HHS will define. So it's not in the statute. The so-called HHS mandate is not in the statute. It's in a rule or regulation published in the Federal Register and promulgated by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Secretary Sebelius enlisted a body known as the Institute of Medicine. I know there are doctors in the room, and you should probably know, you probably know better than I, that the Institute of Medicine is not making judgments strictly on medical criteria, but is a highly ideological arm of experts enlisted by the government. And in this case, they obliged with ideology, not with science. And in July of 2011, the IOM, the Institute of Medicine, recommended to Secretary Sebelius that the category called preventive care include for women, all women, including minor girls, of anyone of childbearing age, include at no cost, the preventive care is to be no cost, all FDA-approved pharmaceutical contraceptives, contraceptive devices approved by the FDA, that would include intrauterine devices, IUDs, all sterilization services approved by the FDA, and all of this, of course, at no cost, no copay, no deductible, in employer-provided health care plans for employees and their dependents. Well, Secretary Sebelius got what she wanted. 1 month later, in August 2011, she published the proposed rule under which we are now governed. Published it for comment. That's the normal way of things, 60 days, 90 days, for comment by the public in August 2011. And again, the rule is all FDA-approved contraceptives and sterilization services. So that includes IUDs, as I said earlier, but it also includes a category of pharmaceutical products that are really best known, better known, as abortifacients and not contraceptives. Because it includes drugs the FDA has approved under the rubric of contraception, such as Plan B and Ella. Plan B, the so-called morning after pill. Ella, sometimes referred to as the 5 days after pill. The FDA and HHS, by the way, and I'll just digress here for a moment, would have you believe that these pharmaceutical products, Plan B and Ella, are not abortifacients. Because they say, and this is where our medical colleagues are so helpful to us and our scientific colleagues are so helpful to us in keeping us on the straight and narrow with the truth. They say that Plan B and Ella are not abortifacients because they prevent implantation of an embryo in the uterine wall. And before there's implantation, there's no pregnancy. And where there's no pregnancy, no abortion takes place. Now, it's an interesting sleight of hand to define pregnancy as commencing with implantation, because we know that there can be a considerable length of time, we know this from science, there is a considerable length of time between conception, fertilization of an egg by a sperm so that we now have an embryo, and implantation. It's during that window of time that Plan B works. It destroys the developing embryo before implantation. So an abortion takes place, but according to the government, no, it doesn't, because pregnancy hasn't happened yet. They're playing with words there. Ella, by the way, can work either before or after implantation. So they're concealing that fact as well. Ella is a drug that can be taken for several days after sexual intercourse and have the effect of destroying an embryo in utero either before or after implantation. Anyway, That's what was approved. And so it's essentially, all employers are now obliged to provide to their employees and their employees' dependents, which could be minor young women, free, no cost, no deductible, no copay, access to abortion-inducing pharmaceutical products approved by the FDA. And what will they approve next? What will they add next? Will they add surgical abortions to the mandate as preventive medicine? After all, we know that abortion prevents something, don't we? It prevents life. It prevents birth. Now, in the original HHS mandate, there was a narrow exemption for religious employers, extremely narrow, so narrow that it caused an instant uproar among religious leaders in many faith communities. The original exemption was for those religious employers who are, involved in chiefly in inculcating the faith, B, employing chiefly their own faith communities members, and C, serving principally their own faith communities members. You can see who this leaves out. This leaves out hospitals, charities, schools, universities. It's confined essentially to houses of worship and no one else. Perhaps a cloistered convent, but not a school run by the Dominican Sisters of Mary who come out of Ann Arbor, right? Because, after all, Catholic schools welcome and instruct many, many non-Catholic students, and so would fall outside the exemption. So, what happened next? Well, there was an instant backlash. The flood of comments into the Health and Human Services Department was amazing, objecting to this policy. But to no avail. In February, a year ago, 2012, the rule was promulgated officially in the Federal Register with no change, not one comma, not one semicolon was moved in the rule that had been published originally in August. However, at the time that the President and Secretary Sebelius announced that the rule would be published as is in February 2012, they also announced that there would be a so-called safe harbor period in which the rule would not be enforced against a category of employers who fall outside the religious employer exemption, but who hold themselves out and in fact are, religious institutions of various kinds. That's all the non-exempted universities, charities, nonprofits, religious ministries of various kinds that could not fit into the narrow confines of the exemption. So Notre Dame University, Belmont Abbey College, Colorado Christian College, a Protestant college, or CCU, Colorado Christian University, EWTN, these employers were left out of the exemption but told that they were in a safe harbor. Why? Because the administration promised they were going to work for the next however many months, they were not very specific about that, on a new rule that would provide greater accommodation for those employers so that they would not have to provide these abortifacient drugs, contraception, and sterilization services. So there was a vague promise in February 2012 of a future accommodation for these religiously affiliated nonprofits. Well, these nonprofits and other employers did not wait on the good faith of the Obama administration. Many of them filed lawsuits. Both religious institutions and for-profit employers alike filed lawsuits. And there are now 49 separate lawsuits involving 140 plaintiffs in federal courts around the country. Practically every circuit of the country has a lawsuit ongoing as we speak. And heroic, dedicated lawyers at the American Center for Law and Justice, the Alliance Defending Freedom, the Beckett Fund, the Thomas More Law Center are prosecuting these cases, litigating these cases, often on shoestring budgets, and they deserve our support. So far, the good news is that in 17 of these cases, we have won 13 injunctions halting the mandate while litigation proceeds. These are preliminary injunctions that don't make a final resolution of the case, but that prevent the government from enforcing the mandate while litigation goes on. So in 17 cases, 13 injunctions. In four cases, we've lost. The injunction has been denied. The most famous and prominent case in which an injunction has not been issued by a judge but has been denied is the case of Hobby Lobby, which is a company based in the West. Maybe you know it. I don't know if they have Hobby Lobbies in the Cleveland area. They don't in the Princeton area. My wife wishes they did. But I'm familiar with them. They're a huge company. The family owning it are evangelical Christians. They refuse to pay for abortifacient drugs for their employees in their group health plan. They have sued. So far, they've lost. The mandate went into effect for them in January. The government is not right now, despite the failure of the company to get an injunction, the government is not demanding payment of the fines. But should they lose in the end and these fines must be paid, they amount to, I think, something like $1.3 million a day for Hobby Lobby, because they have to pay a fine per employee, and they're a huge company. They have, 10,000 employees or something like that, 500 stores in many, many states. But in other cases, injunctions have been forthcoming. So these cases are all headed ultimately to the Supreme Court. I'm optimistic for reasons I'll return to. Last month, Health and Human Services finally announced the shape of the new accommodation for the religious institutions or religious nonprofits, religiously affiliated nonprofits that don't fit into the narrow exemption. By the way, they also tweaked the original exemption a little bit, so it covers just a few more employers, but not many more. They expanded it very slightly. The accommodation, though, for institutions like Belmont Abbey College, Notre Dame University, is grounded on a falsehood. Here's how the accommodation works. Previously, these religiously affiliated nonprofits, like Hobby Lobby or any for-profit corporation, simply had to ante up for the insurance that covers these services and drugs. Now they're told, well, your employees will still get the access to contraception and abortifacients. They never talk about the abortifacients, but they'll get the access to contraception and sterilization services, but you won't have to pay for it and it won't be in your insurance contract. Okay, so the day before yesterday, here's what it was. Company or employer signs a contract with an insurance provider. And the insurance provider in that contract is obligated to provide the contraception and sterilization services. And the company's paying for it, and everybody knows about it, and you go forward. All right, there's an invasion of religious freedom there and a traducing of the sanctity of life, but at least everybody's above board. Now the situation is this. Employer signs a contract with a health insurance provider in which there's no mention of these things, but the insurance provider nonetheless provides to the employees and dependents the very same services. It simply drops out of the contract. It simply vanishes from the contract, but it's still provided, and it's still provided at the employer's cost because there's no savings on the premiums, and it is provided by virtue of the contract. After all, if, say, Notre Dame, well, let me pick a different example because Notre Dame is a self-insurer. Let's suppose Belmont Abbey College had Blue Cross for its employees. Blue Cross would be obligated, as the insurance provider for Belmont Abbey College, to provide the contraception services to all female employees of the college. After the so-called accommodation, Blue Cross would still be obligated to provide the contraception services for the employees of the college. And if the college changed from Blue Cross to Aetna, Aetna would be the new provider of the contraception services for the employees of the college. So who can doubt that it is still utterly dependent on the contractual relationship of the employer to the insurance provider? There's no change. What they've added to the policy, what they've layered over the HHS mandate, is simply a lie. So what you have no substantive change in the policy. You just have the policy plus a lie about it. That's a real change. So the lawsuits continue. The leaders of our great faith communities, including the Catholic bishops, have denounced the fake accommodation as just that, a fraud on the public and themselves. And this is where we are, with lawsuits proceeding apace. There's one more element of the story I'll come to at the end, good news that came out just this week. But let me talk a little bit about what's going on the other side of this issue. What's up with the Obama administration about this? Because throughout this whole struggle, the public campaign of the Obama administration and of the president's reelection effort has been twofold. First, they have argued that this is all about access to contraception. They would have us believe that those of us in the country, the millions of us who object to this policy, are interested in denying women legal access to contraception. Nothing could be further from the truth. Women have had legal access to contraception in every state of the Union since Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965, a Supreme Court case. And nothing's changed about that. Women had access to contraception freely. I don't mean it without cost, but I mean without restraint, before the HHS mandate came down. This did not create access to contraception. What it created was a policy in which other people would have to be, your employers, that is, would have to be complicit in providing the contraception and the abortifacient pharmaceuticals, sterilization procedures, and so on. So it's not about access, but that's the story we've been told. It's all about access to contraception, and this, of course, was blown up into the so-called war on women, with Ms. Sandra Fluke of Georgetown Law School hitting the hustings, with that young woman who's in the show Girls, talking on YouTube about the president's policy and all its wonderfulness for young women. But it's not about access to contraception. It's never been about that. The second element of the, and the more hard-edged element of the Obama campaign's effort to put this over, has been to argue that refusal to cover these procedures and drugs in employer health plans, refusal to cover, is an imposition of one's own religion on one's employees. Okay? That actually the Obama administration, they're the friends of freedom. They're the friends, in fact, of religious freedom, because religious freedom includes the right not to have others dictate to you tenets and precepts of their religion. But this is not about that either. It's no imposition of my religion on another. If I'm an employer and I say, I'm not going to pay for you to do something I think is wrong, I'm not going to give you a coupon for something I believe is evil, how does that impose my religion on that person? She's still free to do as she wishes with her resources, including the salary I pay her if I'm her employer. It's no imposition whatsoever, but that's the story we're told. The Obama administration's claims about a war on women and an imposition of religious values on others who don't share them, these claims are transparently false. So, what's really going on? There is a deep ideological commitment here, and there's crass partisan politics. Let me talk about each of them in turn. In the ideology, the president, Secretary Sebelius, and their cohort, they know that this isn't about access. They know better than that. But they really do believe that contraception and abortion are not just choices women can make. They are great public goods to be provided, to be pushed. That contraception and abortion, remember, this is the most pro-abortion president who's ever served in the Oval Office, Barack Obama. Their belief is that contraception and abortion are inseparable from women's equality, freedom, and dignity. You're here today because you know that's all completely wrong, completely false. That abortion in particular is an assault on women's dignity as well as on the sanctity of life. that it's not a liberation, that it's not a sign of equality, but of subjugation. The other thing that I discovered to my astonishment, and I thought I was over being astonished at things that come out of the Obama administration. I really did. But in February, when they published something in the Federal Register that was that described the new so-called accommodation that turned out to be all smoke and mirrors, 80 pages of blinding bureaucrat ease. By the way, where's Wesley Smith? Is he with us? I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a political scientist, but that means I do have the training to plow my way through 80 pages of bureaucrat ease. So I do this so you don't have to. But to my astonishment, somewhere in the middle of it, when they were talking about how they could fob this off as something that the employers wouldn't really be paying for, and neither would the employees. The employers need, it's somehow free, right? Well, they haven't invented a new constitutional clause that permits them to tell insurance providers to give away goods and services for free. They haven't done that. But they indicated that the way to cover the costs that supposedly no one was going to be liable for, that the coverage of the abortifacients and contraceptives would come about because provision of contraception would lead to fewer childbirths, and the related payments out of insurance risk pools for childbirth, for obstetrics and maternity care. Okay? And then it hit me, because it's right there in black and white, that it's also a great good, according to the Obama administration, that fewer children be born in this country. Now, I urge you to read Jonathan Last's book. It's sitting on my desk reproaching me. I need to read it, but I've read some excerpts. I've read some reviews. Jonathan Last of the Weekly Standard has just published a book titled What to Expect When No One's Expecting, which is about our birth dearth, a term coined years ago by demographer Ben Wattenberg. So it's not a new phenomenon, but you know, we're not having enough babies in this country to replace the people we have. And the Obama administration believes that it's also a great public good to have fewer children born in this country. And if that means more abortions, pharmaceutical or otherwise, if that means more widespread use of contraceptive at the cost of other people not using it and not wishing to pay for it, so be it. In this ideology, there are clear enemies, too. Chief among them, the leaders of the great pro-life faith communities, of what you might call, with a small o, the Orthodox faiths, in which I include Roman Catholics, Orthodox Christians, Evangelicals, Mormons, Jews, Muslims. The leaders of those faith communities, the small o, Orthodox communities, in some cases, capital O, Orthodox Christians and Orthodox Jews. These are clearly the enemies of the Obama administration. Perhaps Catholics above all, because the bishops of the Roman Catholic Church in the United States are such visible champions of life in every diocese and archdiocese. But that's the ideological struggle we're in. Now, let me say a few words about the crass partisan politics of this. It's the politics of the wedge. You've heard of wedge issues. Wedge issues are those issues that you employ to try and divide people from one another. The Obama administration is employing at once in this one policy several wedges. A wedge between generations. They're trying to convert what is now a legally free choice for the young, access to contraception, into a public good that someone owes them. And if they can persuade the young of this, then they make them still more dependent on the government's public policies, perhaps on the government's largesse. They're trying to drive a wedge, a second wedge, between Catholics and other faith communities. This is why there's no talk on the other side about the abortifacient effect of some of the drugs covered by the mandate. They make it all about contraception. because they know that there's really just one large-scale, prominent faith community in the country whose leaders teach and preach about the wrongness of contraception, and that's the Catholic Church. Okay? So they try to make it all about contraception and suppress the fact that abortion is also part of the mandate. The good news is this hasn't fooled. I'm a Catholic. This hasn't fooled our non-Catholic friends, our Protestant friends in particular. Colorado Christian University, not Catholic. Tyndale House Publishers, not Catholic. Hobby Lobby, not Catholics. Okay? They know what's going on. They know that abortion is part of this picture too. These are employers who have no particular qualms derived from their faith traditions about contraception. But they know the destruction of human life when they see it, and they won't be complicit in it. A third wedge they're trying to drive is between people of faith and more secular Americans. By trying to discredit claims that religious freedom is at stake. Or even, as I noted already, to try to turn the tables and say, no, no, it's you all who are trying to impose your religion on other people. To the extent that they can win that argument with the folks that people refer to nowadays as the nuns, I don't mean the ladies in habits I saw earlier this morning, the N-O-N-E-S, the people who, when asked their religious beliefs, check none, none of the above, okay? That's the nuns I'm talking about, not sisters. I see some sisters in the back. If they can make headway with the secular demographic, the people who check none when asked their religious faith, people who, for whom faith has dropped out of their lives, pray to God it will come back for some of these people if it was ever there or will enter their lives. But if they can divide secular Americans from religious Americans and pit us against each other and persuade us that there isn't a freedom we're all obliged to respect that is at stake in this and lives we're all obliged to respect that are at stake in this, then they win. A fourth wedge they're trying to drive is between people in the pews and their clergy. You've all seen the statistics that show that many, many Catholic women of childbearing age use the pill, use contraception. We know that in other faith traditions there are similar divides over social questions. So they're trying to normalize. The government is out to normalize what you might call deviations from the doctrines and teachings of people's religious traditions, and thereby to discredit and damage the witness of pastors, sisters, bishops, archbishops. Another wedge. What am I up to, five now? The fifth wedge. So they're trying to divide, and this is, maybe it's two wedges in one, because we have three categories of employers affected by the HHS mandate now. Originally just two. Everybody covered by it, everybody exempt from it. Now we've got everybody exempt from it, everybody given the fake accommodation in which you lie to yourself and say you're not contracting for contraception for your employees, and everybody we're still telling the truth to who's covered by the policy, right? So religious employers, religiously affiliated nonprofits getting the fake accommodation, and everybody else with 50 or more employees. There are three categories of employers in the HHS rules, and the government is trying to drive a wedge between those employers, the groups, those one category against another. They're trying to persuade us, to persuade religious leaders in particular, to write off the for-profit employers, corporations, as folks who can look after themselves, folks whose religious freedom is not as important as the religious freedom of men in Roman collars, or men and women who had charitable religious ministries. They're hoping that religious employers will sell out the for-profit employers and hoping that the fake accommodation will do its work and will deceive institutional leaders of the religiously affiliated nonprofits. Finally, because this White House and this administration are never less than fully partisan in the narrowest and crassest sense, but trying to drive a wedge between Republicans, between those who accept the mandate and those who reject the mandate, since, of course, it always helps to one's own party if the other is divided. All of this, of course, is in order to further the ultimate goal of achieving greater normalization of abortion in American society. Now, some of these wedges worked well enough to aid the president's reelection. But so far, Catholics and non-Catholics are sticking together, probably because they went a bridge too far and put the abortifacients in there. And so are the three classes of employers. In litigation right now, that's where our hopes rest. Under something known as the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, passed in 1993, and under the Free Exercise Clause, protecting religion in the First Amendment. For the lawyers in the room, I'll give you a rundown of the way in which, and for the non-lawyers, I'll try and make this understandable. It's arcane in some cases. But here are the sorts of things that matter. The policy is not, as the law requires, neutral and generally applicable. One thing I didn't mention is that there are so-called grandfathered plans that are not affected by the HHS mandate at all. And some estimates are that perhaps 100 million Americans, a third of the country, are in grandfathered plans that are not yet affected by the mandate at all. So how can we say that the first criterion of the law, that it be neutral and generally applicable, has even been met? Secondly, it treats identically situated employers in three different ways. Exempted, accommodated, nada. And yet they all have equivalent claims of religious liberty as employers. It directly burdens employers in the second and third categories with responsibility for providing something their faith forbids them to provide. A direct assault on religious freedom. There's no compelling interest. This is legal language, but it's familiar in First Amendment law and constitutional law more generally, that in many cases the government has to show a compelling interest for its policy. But there's no compelling interest to support this imposition, given the widespread, inexpensive access to contraception in this country. Even when the government has a compelling interest, it is obliged, in cases like this, to use the least intrusive means to its ends. If the government wanted, for instance, to improve freely available access to contraception at no cost to women, it could, I'm not suggesting they do this, but it could ratchet up our budget deficits by paying for it itself. Instead, it's making employers do so. So it hasn't chosen the least intrusive means, but the most intrusive means. And as a colleague of mine, the inimitable Dr. Professor Helen Alvarez of George Mason University Law School has said, and you should have her at one of these meetings if you haven't, it invades parental rights. Communicating directly to minor girls about access. As I said, we are 13-4 so far in getting injunctions against the mandate while litigation continues. These early victories, by the way, have come in the cases that should be our weakest because they involve for-profit corporations. Now, the argument of the Obama administration has been astonishing in these cases in particular. And it is this, that if you are in business, in commerce, especially if you are incorporated, you have no religious freedom. None at all. That is, your corporation doesn't, but your corporation is simply an agent of your will. A similar argument that corporations have no freedom of speech was rejected by the Supreme Court 3 years ago in the famous Citizens United case. So that shouldn't fly. As for the religious institutions affected by the mandate, they're being told that they are not in charge of their own institutional integrity. This is a view that was rejected 9-0 by the Supreme Court a year ago in the religious exemptions case of Hosanna Tabor versus EEOC. Finally, note that the administration has conceded that there is a religious freedom issue with this policy. Otherwise, they would not have bothered to create any exemption in the first place. But they did create one for a narrow range of houses of worship. So the truth is, they knew and anticipated religious objections to the mandate and took it upon themselves to decide whose objections were worthy of respect and whose were not. Who has a lot of religious liberty, who has a little, who has none. But under our Constitution, everyone has the same religious freedom.
That's right.
I would add that while only religious freedom is protected from invasion by laws like the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and the Free Exercise Clause, conscience is something possessed by anyone with a moral sense, whether their conscience springs from religious faith or not. So it's very good news, and I've saved this good news for last, that three GOP House members this week introduced H.R. 940. Call your congressman, write to your congressman, support H.R. 940, the Health Care Conscience Rights Act, introduced by Congresswoman Diane Black of Tennessee and two others. This bill would protect anyone's conscientious refusal on religious or moral grounds to providing or paying for abortion or any other item or service to which they object in health care. Now, in the courts and in Congress, we have to carry the fight for life and for freedom, which stand or fall together. The president's campaign got away with its falsehoods about a war on women, and those falsehoods helped get him reelected. Now we have to redouble our efforts about the real war being prosecuted against the first two unalienable rights in the Declaration of Independence, life and liberty. We have right on our side. We have the teachings of our faith, and we have the just principles of our constitutional order. But we need more than right, more than the truth. We need to be smart, to be persuasive, to be tireless, to be passionate, to be unrelenting on every front. Thank you for being here this weekend to be all those things.
We have some questions. We have a lot of questions, and I'm only allowed to ask you two. But what I've done is I've separated them out to those that are familiar with each other anyway. They're basically asking similar. There's only one that was a little off of the subject of the other two. And then Molly Smith is going to answer all of the questions on her radio program. So what you want to do is make sure you have full information about her program. Listen in, because she will be interviewing the different guests and you will get your question answered. The first question, though, is about the individual mandate as it relates to the health insurance. And there are questions that not only asked about, does an individual have to purchase the insurance, or what happens to a Catholic employer to qualify? Do all of the people there have to be Catholic? But in a nutshell, the question is, as an individual who purchases health insurance for myself or my family, is a portion of my premium designated toward the requirements of the HHS mandate?
I'm not sure, but I think the answer is yes. People who buy insurance as individuals either are employed by someone who's not providing it, someone who has fewer than 50 employees, for instance, but the individual finds that he can afford it, he wants it, he buys it, or they're self-employed people. And to my knowledge, you might be able to shop around and find an insurance group plan you could join that doesn't cover these things, but I'm not sure you can. I'm not sure you can. I think that if you go to any of the standard providers of insurance for health care, you're going to wind up in joining some kind of group plan that includes this coverage.
I want to remind you also that the scripture says when God seems hidden, we reach deeper for him. And there are some places in our society still that are private insurers that were exempted out of the HHS mandate. They're very small. They're very Christian. And the only one I remember, because their number is so easy, is 1-800-PSALM-23. But you might want to look into some of the, search it out, Google around, because you're absolutely right, Dr. These these major policies are including these things that we abhor. The other question comes in similar fashion, where many asked about it, you know, that where are the the people, the Protestants, the Orthodox, others, the administration, and are they delaying because of Supreme Court appointments that would be in the future, any type of real controversy, which in a nutshell was asked in this question, can a future secretary appointed in a conservative administration simply change the rules to eliminate all of these abortion rules?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We missed two opportunities in 2012. One was that when Obamacare two core, the whole shebang, was in front of the Supreme Court, there was a slim chance that it would be struck down in its entirety. That is, the entire Affordable Care Act. Now, I know many people are disappointed with Chief Justice Roberts for interpreting the penalty as a tax involving the individual mandate and thus upholding that part of the law. But I have to say, as a longtime student of constitutional law, that even if that had come out our way with Chief Justice Roberts voting with the other four conservatives and declaring the individual mandate unconstitutional, it would still have been another reach, somewhat improbable, for them to have struck down the entire act. Okay? That case involved a part of the Affordable Care Act, and the question was it severable so that even if they overturned the individual mandate, could they overturn it alone without overturning the entire act? So that was a reach. Now, the four justices who dissented, who said we should have overturned the individual mandate, also addressed the severability question and said we would have overturned the act in its entirety. I still think that would have been a reach. So that was the first missed opportunity, because if Obamacare had fallen, the whole edifice had collapsed, like Samson bringing down the Philistines' temple, then there would be no HHS mandate because it's predicated on the statute. If the statute's gone, the regulation's gone. But our other missed opportunity was not electing a new president in November, because a new Secretary of Health and Human Services with a stroke of the pen can undo this particular policy. It is an administrative regulation, not a statutory requirement. It is a filling in of that gap I mentioned at the start of my talk. The secretary shall provide. Well, a new secretary can provide differently and say that preventive services don't cover this. Who, after all, thinks that preventive health services necessarily include monkeying with the human reproductive system? Pregnancy is not a disease. It's not a malady to be cured. It's not. Fertility is health, after all. Fertility is health. So these preventive services, by rights, should have nothing to do with contraception and certainly not abortion.
We're saying time.
We're saying time.
We want to say again thank you to Matthew Frank and the Witherspoon Institute.
You have been listening to Matthew J. Frank, director of the Witherspoon Institute and 2013 Bringing America Back to Life Symposium speaker.